This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. My co-host, Meghna Chakrabarty, is on assignment today. In the news this week, it was all about secret government surveillance programs, your phone and internet records, your security, and your privacy.
We all want to protect our country. We want to protect our fellow citizens. But there is that line where I think we have crossed here.
Also this week, the trial of reputed mobster James Whitey Bulger finally begins with a panel of more than 800 prospective jurors.
The primary thing you want is a juror that can be fair and impartial. It is a daunting challenge.
And in politics this week, sharp disagreements in the first debate between U.S. Senate candidates Gabriel Gomez and Congressman Ed Markey.
That is beyond disgusting.
That's a ludicrous position which he has.
And the Senate tackles the problem of student debt, $1 trillion in growing, unless Congress acts soon.
The government will make $51 billion in profit on student loans. Our students have been turned into a profit center.
So we'll dig into those stories and others with two members of our Week in Review panel. Joining us now is Peter Canellos, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Hey, Peter, happy Friday to you.
Happy Friday to you, Anthony.
Also with us, Peter Ubertasio, chair of the political science department at Stonehill College. And Peter, welcome to Radio Boston. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the big story about the government secret surveillance program. We learned this week that the National Security Agent has been collecting phone records of hundreds of millions of U.S. phone customers. It was first reported by the British newspaper The Guardian. It's ignited a huge debate about privacy and the legality of secret surveillance. Here's Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern on Morning Edition today.
The value of privacy, you know, the protections of our liberties are something that are very unique to this country and something that we have always cherished. The thought that we're going to just kind of put those things aside because we want to make sure we cast a wide net to make sure that we know what everybody's doing in an effort to try to combat crime or terrorism, I think compromises who we are as a country.
Now, President Obama is defending the surveillance. He says Congress has repeatedly authorized it. He says nobody is listening to your telephone calls. Peter, that's the president's view. We also heard from Jim McGovern there. Where's the truth here? How concerned should we be? Do we even know the full extent of this secret surveillance?
Peter, the professor or the editor?
Oh, I'm sorry. Peter Canellos, let's start with you. Yes,
yeah,
we've got two Peters. I'm so used to going to you first. Let me start with you, Peter Canellos.
Okay. Well, I'll say, I mean, it certainly has sparked a kind of visceral concern and the timing of it coming, you know, in the midst of the IRS investigation and some of these other things seems intended by the leaker to kind of suggest that this is a much more surveillance than people had expected. But I wonder whether the second reaction is going to quiet down a little bit. It was not a surprise to me that phone records, not the phone calls themselves, which is the records had been scanned. I think it was a little bit of a surprise that the email messages as well are being checked. I think the visceral sense of violation of people's civil liberties is something that the government has to contend with, and having a kind of open debate and setting practical guidelines for the government's power here, you know, is useful and important in terms of restoring confidence to the government. But I'm not sure that this is some shocking lapse that that people should be outraged over.
Sure. Peter Ubertasio, the other Peter, let me come to you. What's your view? What's your reaction about to what we learned this week?
I agree. I mean, I think that the timing of this is what's causing some of the over-the-top hysteria. I'm not sure there is much of a debate, at least as it pertains to the phone records, that there shouldn't be much of a debate on the legality. Congress has authorized this. The executive branch had to go before a court to get approval to do it, and only for a limited period of time. And the president's right that we're not having our conversations listened to. These are data that they're mining, that they're looking for. I think that a debate on, you know, the appropriate parameters of surveillance is necessary and appropriate for Congress to have. But I think that some of what we're hearing from Congress is an over-the-top reaction to something that is actually legal and that they've authorized.
Well, you mentioned this idea of a debate. I mean, it seems like part of the problem here and part of the sort of problem with the reaction is that the problem here is that so much of the capacity that the government now has grown up so quickly in the wake of 9/11 that we've almost arrived here without a chance to have that debate. Do you agree with that, Peter Ubertag?
I do. I do. One thing that I thought the president touched on today in his press conference, you know, where he talked about trying to have security and liberty and the appropriate boundaries, and suggested that, you know, you can't have 100% security if you don't give up some of those preferences for privacy and secrecy. On behalf of the individual. But I think the problem is you can't have that debate when you're pushed into a corner and the president is forced to defend it at a press conference where he'd rather be talking about, you know, something else. I think that the debate really does need to be open. It needs to be transparent. Congress needs to be having it on a regular basis. The problem, I think, lays in the fact that Congress has, you know, over the past 20 years become so much more partisan that they prefer to attack a president and assume that there's a scandal where one does not exist instead of having a thoughtful debate on these issues.
So, Peter Kanellis, how do we get to that place where the American people can feel a little bit more, I don't know, included in that thoughtful debate?
Well, actually, I'll disagree with one of the things that Peter just said, in that in this particular instance, there's kind of bipartisan support for it. This is not an issue that has played out, at least in the Obama administration, as Democrats and Republicans on different sides shouting about things. So it's almost like the absence of that, because, you know, Dianne Feinstein and Saxby Chambliss both agree this is a good thing and have been consulted on it. You know, there hasn't been an open airing of what's going on. And so some people clearly are shocked about this. So I think that, you know, Congress should have hearings. This is why we have the hearing process. And I think that the appropriate, you know, safeguards to prevent national secrets from being exposed should be in place. But I think that the administration and the officials involved should make an affirmative case for why this is an invaluable tool and why these intrusions cannot possibly go beyond just finding out, you know, who somebody is talking to and who somebody emailed, but not the substance of their emails. I mean, the public needs to hear this.
Indeed. Well, let's move on to the trial of reputed Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger. Jury selection began this week, a seemingly routine procedure that takes place before opening arguments. But in this trial, nothing is routine, or at least it appears that way. Attorneys are going through hundreds of questionnaires from prospective jurors, 860 of them, out of which will come a panel of just 18. Judge Denise Casper is hoping to have the jury sworn in by next Wednesday. That's a couple of days after opening remarks were originally scheduled. So earlier this week, we spoke to criminal defense attorney Joseph Krawski Jr. about the challenge of picking a jury for this case.
The Bulger trial has between 800,000 and 1 million pages of discovery, several hundred witnesses. It's going to take 3 months. You want someone that is going to stay focused and stay sharp. In my opinion, as a defense attorney, you want someone who can think outside of the box and not just assume, of course, he's guilty of all these indictments.
Peter Kanellis, you have legal training. Explain why this jury selection process is so complicated and takes so long.
Well, one of the big problems is that the trial is taking place in Boston, which I think is important. It's important for the people of Boston to be able to pay special attention to this. But there's the potential that jurors will, one way or the other, be influenced or biased either by media coverage or even worse, by some connection to a person involved in the case. And so it's going to take a while to sort all that stuff out. And the last thing that we want to have happen is for Bulger to be convicted, but then there to be some revelation about some serious conflicts of interest on the part of the jury that could lead to an appeal. So I think that all this jury checking and testing and the whole voir dire process is cumbersome, but it's probably necessary in this case.
Peter Ubertasio, what do you observe from this first week in obviously what is going to be a months long trial here?
Well, it's been exhausting already, and they don't yet have a jury. It's been a fascinating insight into the process. I think Peter is quite right that there's so many of us are aware of this case and have been thinking about Whitey Bulger in one way or another for, you know, decades. And the government, I think, and the judge and the defense counsel are doing a very good job of sort of going through these jurors one by one. I would be a little bit surprised if they do, in fact, start on time, just given the amount of work that they've had to slog through and have yet to get through. But it's been a very interesting process to observe.
Mm, it has. I mean, one of the issues that Judge Casper had to resolve right off the bat, and she resolved one of them today, she ruled, and Peter Kanellis, I want to come to you about this because it involves a couple of your colleagues, Shelley Murphy and Kevin Cullen can cover the trial. Bulger's defense team wanted them banned from the courtroom because they said that they might want to call them as defense witnesses. Now, Cullen and Shelley Murphy, of course, have written extensively about Bulger for years, and federal prosecutors said that Bulger was motivated by his hatred toward them. What do you make of this move by Bulger in relationship to your two colleagues there?
Well, it's obviously an attempt by the Bulger defense. Well, it may be an attempt by the Bulger defense to sort of keep them from reporting on the trial, and it may actually just be personal animus. You know, it's a small community over in Southie, and everybody knows each other, and they want to exact revenge sometimes. So I wouldn't even dismiss the idea that it could just be mischievousness. Mm. I can imagine if they did want to put them on the stand, and I, you know, don't think that's going to happen. I don't think Kevin and Shelley would testify in any case. But, you know, they may want to just fish around to see who John Connolly was talking to.
Sure.
And what these people said. And it's totally inappropriate. And I'm glad that the judge decided to allow them to attend the trial.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Kevin Cullen. I'll just read a little bit about what he wrote in his column today. He called this is evidence of Bulger being sublimely vindictive. He writes, "For Whitey, this trial is not about getting acquitted. It's about getting even, and that's why I'm on his witness list." So there are words there from Kevin Cullen in his column today in the Boston Globe. Well, let's move on to the special Senate election in Massachusetts, which is just 2.5 weeks away. This week, Democratic Congressman Ed Markey and the Republican Gabriel Gomez met in their first debate. They argued about national security, about abortion, about guns. Here's Gomez, who says he doesn't support a ban on assault weapons, but does support expanded background checks. That's what Gomez says. Here's Markey responding to that.
That's background checks. That's something that the senators from West Virginia can support. We're Massachusetts. We're special. We're supposed to be the leader. We know that the assault weapons should be off the streets. We know that high-capacity magazines should be banned. That is a huge difference between what you and I are promising the people of Massachusetts that we'll do.
And for his part, Gabriel Gomez says the big difference is he's a fresh face, a fresh voice, a new guy. He would be a newcomer to Washington. He accused Markey of being part of a polarized Washington establishment.
It's dysfunctional and it's a failure, and there's a lack of transparency, and that there is an overbearing, arrogant attitude about D.C., about all of D.C. And you've been down there for 40 years, Congressman. You are basically Washington, D.C.
You are basically Washington, D.C. Peter Ubertasio, did this debate change the look of this race in any way?
I don't think so. I think that Gabriel Gomez is facing the problem that most Republicans here face. They have to run two races simultaneously, one against their own party. Mm. He's trying to do that, and two against a Democratic opponent. Democrats have the edge in just about every way. In a statewide race in Massachusetts, Markey is leading in all of the polls. He's led consistently. He's got a financial edge, and there's very little that happened the other night, I think, that is going to shake up this race.
What do you, Peter Kanellis, do you agree with that? Did it help or hurt anybody, that debate, or change the complexion of the race in any way?
I think it helped Markey because the big hope of the Gomez crowd was that Markey would come out looking terrible and that Gomez would really force people to look at him again. And I think, as Peter said, you know, they may have both kind of made their arguments, you know, somewhat inarticulate way, actually. But they both may have made their arguments. But even if you count it as a draw, that's a win for Markey. And so Markey clearly got more out of the debate than Gomez did. You know, I think that's unfortunate is that it has been kind of reduced to sound bites, and partly because neither of these candidates are great communicators. Mm-hmm. You know, there was that sort of finger-pointing style that they both had, and you sense that the argument that Gomez wanted to make in that clip that we were hearing was, look, you know, I'm going to come down and I'm going to build bridges and I'm going to try to get this thing done, and we care more about getting done, or we should care more about getting done what can can be gotten done than to be up there on a podium, you know, screaming about an assault weapons ban that nobody thinks Congress is going to be in a position to pass. And that's a decent point of view, but I thought Markey got the better of the exchange just because Gomez kind of didn't explain himself well.
And it's interesting, if you look at those polls with those all-important unenrolled independent voters, they're sort of running even, which you would think would be sort of good for Gabriel Gomez, but of course, because he's so far behind with Republican voters in this state, running even isn't good enough among those independent voters.
It's not. He's got to appeal to Democratic voters and to Democratic-leaning unenrolled voters, and I'm not sure that their strategy in this sprint is moving those voters toward them. The constant attacks on Markey and on Washington are not really resonating the way that I think they hope they would.
Well, let's move on to the problem of federal student loans. Right now, Americans owe $1 trillion in outstanding student loans, and that debt could be getting even bigger, and that's because interest rates on government-subsidized student loans will double next month unless Congress acts. There are a number of bills and proposals in Washington to prevent the rate hike, one of them from Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who told us yesterday that the current system is wildly unfair. Her idea is a one-year temporary fix to bring interest rates down to the same low rate that the government charges the big banks to borrow money. That's at 0.75%. So here she is talking to us yesterday.
The government will make $51 billion in profit on student loans. Our students have been turned into a profit center. So as a country, if we're going to sit around and invest in these large financial institutions, I think we ought to at least give that good a deal to our students who are trying to get an education.
So Peter Kanellis, on the face of it, that sounds like an attractive idea. But the problem is this isn't going anywhere in Congress. Her proposal isn't going anywhere in Congress. What do you make of her argument and what needs to be done down there?
Well, they definitely need to prevent the automatic increase from taking hold. And I think that this is a serious problem. But I think there needs to be a comprehensive kind of fix that also includes the universities, because while the universities would love to stand by and say the beneficiaries of all these programs are the students and the students alone, it really is pumping money into the universities, the colleges and universities, as well as helping the students. And, somewhat like the healthcare issue, you know, if we're going to get these costs under control, the universities have to play a role, just like the insurance companies and the hospitals do. And unfortunately, that's the kind of comprehensive approach that needs to be taken once the short-term concern about the raising of the interest rates on the Pell Grants is taken care of.
Well, Peter, say more about that. When you say the universities have to get involved, how so?
Well, President Obama in his last two State of the Union addresses has talked about unsustainable increases in tuition. Mm-hmm. And I think anyone who's walked on a university campus, and all of us in Boston have, has noticed that over the last 20 years, there are new buildings, there's new parks, there's new facilities, that, you know, it is a thriving economic center. At the same time, there's a real crisis out here that people in universities recognize, that students won't be able to afford the tuition going forward. And to say that the solution to all of that is the federal government has to subsidize these loans at an even greater rate, at 0.75% in the case of Senator Warren, is only part of the problem, because you really want to bring down the costs on the university side as well. And you can't just pump money in on one side and let the university spend it at will on the other side. Mm.
And Peter Ubertasio, what's your view on this? Do you agree with Peter that this is really a much bigger problem that needs to be tackled?
It is. A comprehensive approach to this issue is necessary, but that highlights the dysfunction in the current Congress. That Warren's bill is not going anywhere. It doesn't surprise me. There isn't much going anywhere in Congress these days. The best that we can do on so many issues is to get a short-term, quick fix to a problem that doesn't address it in any kind of comprehensive way. And we in the greater Boston area are particularly face this issue much more difficulty than in a difficult sense than other places, because we have a high cost of living and we're not retaining enough college graduates here as much as we would like. And so we are graduating students with unsustainable debt. They're leaving the area in part because we have a high cost of living. And so a comprehensive approach to how we structure student loans and the cost of tuition is something that it's been a long time since passing. We've needed this, and it's simply not happening in Congress these days.
And it's funny, it didn't happen yesterday. Elizabeth Warren's bill didn't go before Congress, but another Democratic bill did that would have frozen the rate at the current 3.4% for 2 years. They had enough votes. They had a majority vote to support it. They couldn't get the 60 votes to end debate. So another day, it didn't go anywhere.
And it's one of those things that folks look at the headline and say, well, you know, a majority supported that, and yet it still doesn't advance. And mm-hmm. I think that's just what we've come to expect from this current Congress.
Well, let's move on to our hubbub, that story that didn't make it quite above the fold this week. Peter Canellis, what's your hubbub this week?
Yeah, jumping off the last conversation we just had, McGraw-Hill, the textbook manufacturer, is moving into the Boston Innovation District to create a kind of e-education brainstorming center, which could become a wonderful new economic sector for Massachusetts, you know, helping to come up with creative ways to extend the education mission online. In the case of McGraw-Hill, they're a textbook publisher. They're looking into ways to enhance the textbook experience online. This could be a significant growth industry for Massachusetts in a way of establishing the Innovation District down on the South Boston waterfront as a real font of innovation.
Fascinating. Peter Ubertasio, how about your hubbub?
Well, a little slice of life and history. I was reading the Cape Cod Times this morning. I live on the Cape, and there was a great piece by Heather Wasaki on the dwindling number of D-Day veterans. Mm. And the great part of this story is that there's a couple in Centerville, Edouard and Francois Rocher, Edouard lived in France at the time of the D-Day invasion. They now live in Falmouth. And every year since 1994, they have hosted Cape Area World War II veterans, particularly those that participated in D-Day. That they're down to two at their annual luncheon this year. Next year is the 70th anniversary of D-Day, and there are very real concerns about whether they'll have any veterans left to honor. I think, obviously, it's the march of time, but it also it does something to, our historical memory and our culture when we no longer have a direct connection to events such as that.
Absolutely. Time marches on. Well, here's my hubbub. I'm continually amazed about the incredible work that's done in Boston hospitals. And here's something that I had no idea was going on. I'm reading now from the Associated Press. A 2,500-year-old Egyptian mummy is coming out of its coffin to undergo cleaning and restoration procedures at Mass General Hospital. The mummy has been on display at the third oldest hospital in the country since it was received as a gift in 1823 as a medical oddity. And today, a conservator trained in restoring ancient artifacts will remove him from his coffin and use cotton swabs to wipe away salt deposits from his face, among other work to stabilize him. This is a 2,500-year-old mummy. Apparently, he was a 40-year-old stone cutter from the ancient city on the Nile that is now known in Egypt as Luxor. Anyway, fascinating work there. Who knew? Peter Canellis, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe, thanks so much for joining us today and have a great weekend.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Peter Ubertasio, chair of the political science department, Stonehill College. Great to have you in today. Have a great weekend as well.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, stay with us as Boston celebrates Gay Pride this week. We look at the city's contribution to the national gay rights movement. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.